Before we go any further, Jordan, let's just explain that we're talking about a critics poll that you are going to be posting Monday morning. Monday morning. And basically, you kept out, you've done many polls but this is a strictly a critics poll, and it is something like, what did you say, 65 or 70 people, something like that?
Oh, we ended up getting almost 100
Okay.
at the end.
All right.
I mean, I've been doing this mid-year poll for the last 4 years.
Okay.
So this is the first one, and it's always interesting to see
Right.
what movies are highlighted by critics at the
Right.
halfway
Right.
mark. And really, this year is pretty unique. Situation
Yeah.
in that it's not like we had Cannes or South by Southwest
Yeah.
to really add in some titles and nor really a summer movie season which
Right.
usually has some highlights
So De Five Bloods was far and above the it was 49 votes for De Five Bloods, and that and your the people who responded were not just people in the in your age group of 30s and but older folks also, right? You got some veterans. Okay. Yeah.
Bob Kohler and
Right.
a lot of Barry Hertz, a
Right.
lot of veteran seasoned film critics, and the Five Bloods came out on top.
Yeah.
It's quite an interesting list because you do have a big chunk of the top 20. I think seven of the top 20 movies were released in theaters before the pandemic hit.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, I
Right.
mean you have The Invisible Man, which surprisingly finished third.
Let's just go down the list, shall we, and let's exchange views about them. And rather than doing any sum ups, I'll start. I mean, I didn't actually share my views for this podcast yet about The Five Bloods, but basically, it's a film that I respect by Spike Lee, but I do not think it's one of his best. I do not think it's on the level of Inside Man, or I don't think it's as good as The 25th Hour. I don't think it's as good as BlacKkKlansman, and I wasn't even that much of a fan of BlacKkKlansman, but I was a moderate fan. So that's my feeling. I mean, I'm not. I think that The Five Bloods has ridden the current of the culture right now, which is very caught up in demonstrations against police and Black Lives Matter. And since Spike is a very skillful editor, and he's managed to kind of create a editing swirl of just the past and the present, and bring in BLM as a element in his film. So I think that he caught some of what's happening now, and that's what people are partly, at least partly, responding to. So that's my feeling about that.
As I mentioned to you before the podcast started, the three best Spike Lee movies of the last 20 years are 25th Hour, Inside Man, and BlacKkKlansman, and he didn't write any of those three movies.
Right.
But he does get credited as having written the screenplay for
Yeah.
The Five Bloods, which is a very messy, passionate, political,
Yeah.
disjointed
Right.
screenplay, which doesn't really have
Right.
much of a tone, really. I mean,
Right.
it's just all over the place.
All right, number two in your list is Never, Rarely, Sometimes, Always, which I immediately started calling the United States answer to 4 months, 3 weeks, 2 days. It's basically an abortion. Two young women trying to get an abortion under somewhat difficult circumstances. Never, Rarely, Sometimes, Always, which debuted at Sundance, which I saw sometime later. It's about a couple of women from Pennsylvania, rural Pennsylvania, it's kind of right-wing Pennsylvania, going to Manhattan and some difficulty finding someone who will handle the abortion. And it struck me as mainly a film about how guarded and how sad, really, how sadly guarded the Lee character, whose name I don't have the notes in front of me, but that's what I got more of it, because she seemed so unwilling to open up, to share, even with that kindly woman who offered her and her friends a bed to stay in so they wouldn't have to scrounge around for a place to stay in New York. It's a very, very tough film. Anyway, what was your feeling about it, and do you think it deserved to be number two?
That was a movie that actually got theatrically released before the pandemic and the shutdown happened. I really liked the movie when I saw it at Sundance, and I thought it was one of the highlights of the festival. And I was just gripped.
How do you think it compared to 4-3-2?
Accomplished the movie as 4-3-2.
Mm-hmm.
There are some narrative bumps here and there.
Right.
Whereas the Romanian movie is just pretty much perfect.
Mm.
I was gripped. It's a very gripping movie that doesn't have too much dialogue. It really is more about, you know, inner kept emotions and really about this very silent journey to get at trying to get an abortion. And I mean this year's Sundance was pretty weak, so
the director seemed to go to great lengths to really stick to a kind of a shorthand in terms of dialogue. And I mean, she told you as little as possible and just kind of let the mood of it, the emotion of it, that the poor young woman who's looking to get an abortion, obviously a very unhappy and having had a pretty tough life, as evidenced by that one scene. Remember when she asked, that's the big scene in the film, when she asks about, have you ever had this happen? And the answers are never, rarely, sometimes, always. And she starts gently asking her about her relationships, and it's a sad scene. It really gets you. It's very sad.
Yeah, and it's still very ambiguous what exactly happened to her.
Yeah, yeah.
And I like that. It leaves a little mystery there, and it leaves it up to the viewer to kind of put everything together. But Eliza Hittman is the director, and she's her last movie before this one was Beach Rats, which I really liked. That was also in Sundance.
So the next one is Invisible Man, which I thought was, like Spike's film, is riding a cultural current on its own. If you just look at that movie, which is basically about a stalker, asshole, monster husband who's has the capability of being invisible, and poor Elizabeth Moss is the victim, but it's basically it was a metaphor, I thought. It was a metaphor for oppressive dickhead boyfriends and husbands doing horrible things to their partners, and it was kind of a Me Too movie,
It's really well directed. Leigh Whannell directed this very, very gritty and low-fi movie called Upgrade.
Yeah.
Okay. And I also dug The Invisible Man for what it was, really. I mean, it's a horror movie with obviously, as you said, cultural, social, political subtext, and she's really great in it. Moss, and I usually don't like the Moss in many things, save for Mad Men.
This is a Blumhouse film. So, Blumhouse is not exactly elevated horror. I mean, they're kind of right down there, you know. I thought it was I called it a half-decent, if uninspired, genre exercise. Not bad, but it's a genre film, you know.
It's not Hereditary, it's not The Witch.
Yeah,
I mean, those movies, elevated horror.
Yeah.
But it's quite entertaining, and the whole subtext of the Me Too subtext adds something extra to it as well.
Yeah. Okay, number four is number four is Bad Education, which is not theatrical. That was an HBO film. I thought that was actually of the top four on your list. That would be my favorite of the top four, because I didn't think it was a great film, but it was certainly intriguing, and it's based upon a real life episode that happened in Long Island, and it's pretty nicely assembled, and it was about Jesus. How did the thievery on the part of a school administrator and a partner? How did they ever think they're going to get away with it? But it's kind of about how the people who are basically felons are there's a kind of madness belief that they think believe that they're going to get away with it. That's what I kept saying. There's no chance of you guys getting away with this. You're dealing with, you know, money that's going to be discovered sooner or later as having been pilfered improperly or illegally.
I saw it as a tip, and I thought it could have been a big player, Oscar player for the acting, especially Hugh Jackman. I don't think I've ever seen him give a better performance than this.
He's good. He's very good. And Allison Janney's very good also.
I was looking through his filmography. I'm like, you know what? I think this is the best performance he's ever given.
Yeah.
And so it's a real shame that it never got theatrical, but in the end, it didn't really matter because the pandemic hit and just went to HBO. And I mean, it's quite impressive to see it getting this many votes, given that it's an HBO movie. But it just goes to show how you highlight their worst in this movie year so far. And also, it seems as though studios don't really want to invest in this kind of, smart, well-written drama.
Yeah.
It's starting to become rarer and rarer to see this kind of movie show up in theaters. So, good for HBO to having picked this one up, and good for critics to have noticed it, because I didn't think it would be this noticed.
Now, the first thing I heard about The Assistant, which is kind of like a Harvey Weinstein movie, except from the vantage point of one of his victims in the office. I was told by a major exhibitor based out here at the Spirit Awards which is right before the Oscars, last February, he said he felt that there was nothing there. He didn't feel it was well constructed enough to make you interested. It's just kind of very, again, very minimalist. And he said, I wouldn't hurry to see it. I mean, see it, by all means, if you want. But it's certainly underwhelming as far as I'm concerned. What was your feeling?
I think this is another movie that is being heavily pushed because of its connection to Me Too and because the current atmosphere going on in the States. Minimalist is the right word to describe this, but there's also some pretty fascinating stretches in the movie where you kind of see the monster. You never truly see the monster.
Yeah.
But you hear of him. You hear him on the other end of phone calls. You hear him shouting while his office door is closed, but you never truly see him. You just feel his presence. It's all about secretary and assistant, yeah. and just the abuse that she gets from him throughout. And there's a funny stretch where his wife shows up at the office, and she wants to talk to him, and she's pretty sure that he's with another woman. I think it's well worth a watch, actually, and it's pretty short too. I think it's under 90 minutes.
So arguably, the top of the thing here, I mean, this sort of makes a point. You could argue, I'm not saying this is absolutely a fact, but you could certainly argue that The Five Bloods was the interest of popularity among critics of The Five Bloods is partly the ongoing cultural thing right now. You could argue that Invisible Man certainly has a kind of a Me Too, awful boyfriend, awful husband vibe to it. You can argue that The Assistant is a cultural thing. You know, there's like three of them in the top five so far. It's like,
four, because Never, Rarely, Sometimes, Always is directed by a woman, and it deals with a very political issue in the United States.
Yeah, sure.
So four of the top five are politically driven.
Right. By the way, I finally saw your number six, the number six on your list, First Cow. I finally got through it, and we talked about it briefly, and it's made the whole film festival circuit, and it's streamable right now to anybody who wants to see it. So I don't want to be a spoiler, but basically the two main characters are come to die at the end, and I felt that the circumstance, the cause of this, was maddeningly vague and not satisfying. I know that the emotional point was that they were close. Yeah, they were close to each other, and I felt came to like the film, or at least respect the honesty of it, but I felt that just basically they're being these poor guys being enterprising enough to steal the milk from a rich man's cow and create a little business. I don't think that was a capital offense. I don't think that death was a appropriate response, but that's more or less what it comes down to, and I'm very sorry.
I don't even think it's a spoiler to say that they die, because at the beginning you see
that's right. The very beginning, we see Brad Pitt's best buddy, Alia Shawkat, finding the bones of these two. I mean, she's in a lot of indie stuff. You know, when you see her, it's like, okay.
She's underused here, though. She's in the movie for like 3 minutes.
Yeah, no dialogue.
First Cow has a very strong middle section. It becomes a sort of, as I told you before, a foodie movie about these two men in they try to make a business and a living for themselves with this oily cake.
I swear to God, it looks so tempting. You can almost taste it. You can almost smell. The because we've all had really tasty muffins, and it's like, wow, I really you feel enthusiasm for these guys, and it's the first time that the movie really comes alive when they start to actually figure out a way to sell these things to the people living at this outpost, including the late René Auberjonois, and a couple of other actors that I recognize. What's his name, who plays the rich guy?
The guy who played Capote at some point?
Yeah, it'll come back to me.
I can't remember his name.
Toby Jones. Toby Jones.
Yeah.
Toby Jones.
Toby Jones. Right. Yeah, he's very good in this movie, actually.
Yeah.
He plays like the rich morgue resident of that town, right. Myers, the cook.
Right.
To make a French pastry.
Yeah.
But But Kelly Reichardt, I know you're not a fan of her films, and this is very, very much a Kelly Reichardt movie. There's slow stretches here and there. Takes its time to really build up.
It's really slow, but that's she's always slow. She'll never do a fast-paced film. But you know something about Kelly Reichardt's film, which I felt this way about Meek's Cut Off. I trust those films. I don't feel irritated. I know that she's being honest, and she's got her own style and her own pacing, her own way. She loves the 1.3, 1.37 photography. I trust them. Yeah. I don't hate them. They don't bother me. I just wish that there was more energy coming out of them, I guess. She's not interested in telling anything swiftly. She's not interested in anything more than just really plain filmmaking.
So. She's allergic to formula.
Yeah.
She goes by her own, her own views, with every movie. And I actually, as I mentioned before, the middle section here is very strong, and it's really one of the best things she's done.
Yeah, yeah.
In her career.
Yeah. Okay, next on your list, the critics list, is Baccarat, which we both saw in Cannes last May. May of 19, I should say. And I felt that it was, it's supposed to be a sort of a grim, sort of metaphor for how wealthy, greedy people treat the people of Brazil. And it's kind of about what a grotesque social class thing it is, and there's a lot of horrible, bloody, violent murder, and I didn't, wasn't my thing at all. I didn't like it, and I felt it was gratuitous. Actually, it struck me as gratuitous, but a lot of people in Cannes, you recall that it was. I couldn't understand why they were that praising of it. But they were, and I don't even recall if it has streamed here yet. Has it?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, it was, all right. I even think it got a theatrical release.
Okay.
In February or March, definitely before the pandemic
hit.
Right.
Yeah.
It had some social political context to it. If you know the current situation in Brazil, it's definitely an interesting watch. But it's done through the lenses of a B movie, a midnight movie.
Yeah.
There's a lot of as you mentioned, gore and action and I mean it was praised. Because of its relevance to today's Brazil, and I even interviewed the filmmakers, and they were quite passionate about what was going on in their country, understandably so.
Yeah. For those who don't care anything about South American or Brazilian politics, it's a metaphor about the behavior and the evil nature of the right-wing government that is currently headed by Jair Bolsonaro, the president of Brazil, who recently contracted the coronavirus.
Hydroxychloroquine Lord went.
Yeah, that's funny. That's funny. Yeah.
And that he's doing really well.
Yeah.
But I mean, it's also about the class divide. There's a lot of classes
right.
in social classes in Brazil, and this film depicts
right.
one of them. I mean, it's a pretty poor village that has its own traditions, religious traditions, and outside government forces basically threaten them in the movie. It's quite interesting when you know the situation in Brazil. It's an interesting watch.
The next one is called Vast of Night, which I first encountered when it was playing at Slam Dance at Park City.
Did you actually see it at Slam Dance? Yeah.
I didn't actually see it at Slam Dance. I had to see it later, but I intended to see it at Slam Dance, and I was saying to myself, well, this sounds pretty cool. You know, like it's basically a less is more sci-fi invader film. It's set in the 50s. It's kind of plays along it's supposed to make you feel like you are in the 1950s. It's set in New Mexico. And then when I watched it, I felt really kind of underwhelmed because there's just a lot of, I didn't feel a lot of tension, and I felt a lot of dead space. I appreciated what he was trying to do, and I didn't hate it or anything, but I don't understand why people felt it was that good. It was okay.
I'm 100% with you there. I think it's maybe the most overpraised movie of the year. It's right up there with Flatwoods.
Yeah.
Me.
Yeah.
I remember Steven Soderbergh was a big fan of it. He recommended it to you, I think, or he recommended it to someone who recommended it to you.
Yep.
And so I was intrigued by the buzz that was going on with this movie at Slam Dance, and when I finally saw it, it was, the filmmaking is really, really top-notch for what is essentially, in my opinion, a student movie, almost like a student movie in place. There's I think, four really long monologues in this movie that are so unnecessarily stretched out, and then it ends with a whimper.
There's also a lot of long tracking shots in the beginning. Remember, he kind of follows him inside the base, the basketball, then you walk with him all the way back to the radio station, which is like the small, you know, it's like three or four blocks away. It's like a lot of just walking and waiting. And this is interesting. We're staying with him and no cuts. But I didn't find it that riveting, frankly.
Right. It was almost overly stylized.
Yeah.
It is an overly stylized movie. He's basically trying to tell you, look what I can do.
Right.
I think his name is Andrew. The director's name is Andrew Patterson. I mean, he could have a very bright future ahead of him. The script in this movie is not good at all. And also, as you mentioned, he lets shots linger for too long.
Yeah.
And but the photography is really beautiful.
The night photography is not beautiful in my view. It's too dark.
Yeah, I was gonna say, even though some of the night shots are a little too dark.
Yeah.
The indoor shots are really pretty well realized.
I thought the idea was to recreate the vibe of a 1950s sci-fi alien invader film. So, but he didn't shoot it.
Though.
Huh?
It ripped off the Twilight Zone.
Yeah. Yep. But it didn't feel like it was shot on. Was I wrong? Did they shoot it on film?
It looks like it was shot on film.
Okay. Why didn't they use it with
the old
aspect ratio? Why didn't they shoot it with the 1.37? I mean, I don't recall that it was shot that way. Maybe I just said something incredibly stupid or shows that I have a weak memory, but I don't recall that it had an organic feeling of a film shot back then. But maybe I'm wrong.
know.
You can't remember the aspect ratio, right?
I can't remember. Okay. I saw it a while ago. But at the same time, I didn't see it in theaters. Maybe those dark shots play better in a big screen.
Maybe.
On a big screen. I don't know.
Well, I'll tell you right now that I'm looking at the trailer just to remind myself. And it's shot in a kind of a very wide screen, like 2.55:1, 2.37, 2.39:1. It's not shot in a, you know, in a 50s thing. It's fine, you know. It just didn't have an atmospheric 1950s feeling to it. But I did like the authentic small town vibe. That was nice, you know.
Right. And, the shots that took place in the high school were really interesting.
Yeah.
But I mean, if you see its Rotten Tomatoes rating, it's at 63%.
Mm.
So it's definitely not connected. It didn't connect with audiences. Its IMDb rating is a fairly weak 6.7 out of 10.
This is remember, these are audience numbers, not critic numbers that you're passing along,
exactly.
Right? Yeah.
Exactly.
Okay.
All
right. Now then. Go ahead.
The same goes for The Five Bloods, which now its Rotten Tomatoes rating, I think, is in the low 50s for audience scores.
Right.
I mean, when it comes to the Bats of Night and The Five Bloods, there's definitely a disconnect between critic and audience member.
Now, by the way, I just want to tell you, Shirley, the thing about Shirley Jackson that Elizabeth Moss stars in, that's something that recently opened, actually, just last month, and it's Neon. I didn't actually get around to seeing it, did you?
Yeah, I saw it at Sundance.
Okay.
It played there, but I thought it was going to be great as well. I mean, it's a female director. It's about a fairly well-known female author.
Yeah.
It doesn't play so well. I mean the film is unique in the way it tells the story. I think there's a lot of ambiguity between the characters, but it really didn't connect for me in terms of, you know, the way it presented the drama. And the relationships. I felt very disconnected to the movie, and it's already being forgotten, really, to tell you the truth. It was really, really praised at Sundance, but I think it's pained down a bit since then, and I can't see this movie connecting with, like, as you call Joe and Jane Hawthorne. It's such an obtuse, cold movie. I'd be curious to hear your thoughts on it when you do see it. You should definitely see it. I mentioned how Invisible Man is really one of the best performances.
Yeah. Speaking, by the way, of Sundance hits or films that made at least a big impact at Sundance, what has happened to Promising Young Woman, which got a lot of attention when it played at Park City? It opened there on the 25th. It does not. It has a Focus release date. I should say Focus has agreed to distribute it. But I don't see it on the slate at all. Nothing.
It was supposed to come out in April.
Okay.
But obviously, things changed.
Yeah.
Now I'm hearing that it will most probably appear at TIFF. They have selected a few Sundance titles.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, there's not much to pick from this year. So, Tiff will be a mix of Berlin, Sundance, Cannes titles, plus a few decent world premieres, but nothing more than that. I would be very surprised if you don't get to see a young, promising young woman before the year is out. I mean,
because that doesn't strike me as a Joe Popcorn film either, does it? You saw it, right? I mean, it's kind of a Me Too, angry woman, woke thing, right? Isn't it? Scumbag boyfriends and people trying to take advantage of it.
It's an entertaining enough movie. It had my attention from beginning to end because I was like, okay, where are they going with this? And it does surprise. It have a few neat twists at the end. Terry Mulligan's really good in it.
Yeah.
But I mean, it's shot in a very commercial way.
Yeah.
It's very mainstream and it could connect with audiences. But at the same time, I mean, it could also, you know, piss off fanboys. Who clearly don't like the message that the movie is delivering.
The kind of fanboy types that she winds up wreaking her vengeance on, I guess, no? Isn't that kind of the case?
Pretty much, you know. Yeah. I mean, the main her main targets in the movie are frat boys.
Yeah.
Okay. So, you know, I mean, toxic masculinity at its peak.
Yeah.
You know, and I mean, it's a revenge movie.
Yeah.
There's a lot to admire in there, but it's also a kind of done in a very obvious way. You know, there's nothing subtle about this movie. Mm. I'm not gonna say I'm mixed on it. I didn't find it compulsively watchable and entertaining for what it was, but it's another overpraised Sundance movie, that's for sure.
Well, talk about movies that are it's very curious that the just open Palm Springs, which was people were ecstatic about at Sundance, tell me if I'm wrong, and it did get a purchase price of $17 million and 69 cents, so it would come out a little bit ahead of what was the other one that was? Oh yeah, Birth of a Nation. So anyway, that's right now as we speak. Rotten Tomatoes critics 92%, which is that's pretty fucking high. And yet on your years so far, the 6 months of the first year, critics that you spoke to have it in 23rd place, 22nd place, something like that. So how do you figure that? I mean, if it's a 92 and they all think it's great, how did that happen? How do you explain that?
I don't think enough people saw it.
Okay.
The critics many of them had confessed that they hadn't seen Palm Springs and Hamilton yet.
Well, how can they be regular critics if they're not, you know, if your main thing as a part of what I do, which is, you know, a bit of everything, you have to see stuff pretty close to its opening, no?
Well, Palm Springs, I was polling critics before it was released.
Okay.
Friday, but Hamilton, I don't know why.
Yeah. I'll tell you why, because they don't think it's a movie.
Well, it's technically not cinema.
It's certainly not cinema. If this is a thing presented for the stage and very well choreographed and very well handled on the basis of a stage thing, but it's obviously not a film.
Yeah.
You know,
no, it's for people
not a movie.
Afford a ticket to Hamilton.
Yeah.
It's a chance for those people to watch it at home.
Yeah.
I do know that the decision Disney made in filming the play and putting it on Disney Plus was a very successful one, it seems, because, I mean, it's getting millions of views, and critics, for some reason, went completely gaga over it.
Yeah.
But justifiably so, it will not be eligible for Oscars, justifiably so. I don't really think it should be up for Oscars.
No, nor do I.
No.
All right. Well, listen, we could. There's another one that I guess. There's another thing that I was kind of surprised about how low it is, and Hamilton. I understand what they're talking about. The True History of the Kelly Gang. I thought was abominable. I really didn't care for that. That's like number 23. You know what was really good? What I really went nuts about last May in Cannes was Wild Goose Lake, and I think that's really something, you know, in terms of a man on the run, a hunted man, kind of a film noir, you know, gangsters, untrustworthy people of the underworld, that kind of thing. I really like that film. And I also want to say, before we cut this off, is you were not as much of a fan of The King of Staten Island as I was, right? But you did you like flat out dislike it, or what was your?
I really liked the hangout scenes in the movie at the beginning. I let you know where he's with his friends and they're just hanging out, talking.
Yeah.
I really didn't like the scenes with Bill Burr.
With who?
Bill Burr.
That's the whole thing, though. That's the whole conflict.
I know, exactly. Yeah. So the first half I really liked, but, I mean, the second half when it starts to get into the rivalry between his mom's new boyfriend and himself, that's when the movie kind of lost me.
It felt honest to me. Like, he was coming from his own life, first of all, about his dead father, who... I thought it was an excellent choice, by the way, that they did not try to milk the 9/11 thing in the movie, his father did not pass during the tragedy of 9/11, but just from a regular fire.
And I was surprised by that because, I mean, I thought I had read a few reviews that mentioned that his dad in the movie died on 9/11, which, I mean, is totally wrong.
Completely wrong, yes. His real father did. The movie father did not. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, that was a nice touch to not hammer it down.
Yeah.
In the fiction.
And I felt that. Listen, you can't just leave a person in this state of arrested development. He's like an 11-year-old. I mean, you know, this kid comes up who's maybe 9 years old at the most, 10. And he thinks he might be old enough to get a tattoo, and he gives him that. This guy is really out on the planet Pluto in terms of his. He's the first scene. He's driving on a highway, and he closes his eyes, thinking this is the way to kill myself, and incidentally kill some others because I'll slam into somebody and maybe kill them. I mean, this guy says this is really out there. I mean, this is not.
Right.
You know.
That was my problem with the movie. That first scene is really just grabs your attention, and the following scenes with the friend and giving the tattoo to the kid that grabs your attention as well. You're really into the movie, and then it shifts 180 to his rivalry with his mom's boyfriend.
You didn't like the stuff with Belle Powley? I thought she was... It was the best thing she's ever done, in my book. No, Belle Powley, the young woman...
Oh, Belle Powley, yeah. I really liked the stuff with Belle Powley. But I thought there wasn't enough of it.
Yeah.
You know, I thought she was underused. She's really good in the movie.
Yeah.
As you can see, I'm mixed on it. I'm not negative. You know, I didn't dislike it.
Anyway, you know, that movie died pretty quickly as far as a streamer. And the talk, and tell me what you think, is that they overpriced it. It's not a movie that people wanted to pay $20 to see. It's more like a $12 movie. And I can see the point of that. Do you agree with that?
No, I agree with that. Mm. I mean, if you ever release a blockbuster online, then yeah, the studio can probably get away with charging $20-$30 for that movie.
30? Who's charged 30?
Oh, you'd be surprised. If they released Christopher Nolan's Tenet online, you can bet you'd have millions of people paying up to $30 for that. But it's never going to happen, but I'm just giving an example here. But
it's quite possible that Tenet will have to do a theatrical plus day and date. You never know. I mean, you and I would not miss the opportunity to see it in a big screen for the world, and I would never want to stream it. But maybe they'll do that, you know, because they have to keep pushing the date back. You know?
I really think the movie year is canceled. I really think that is that's the dirty little secret that nobody wants to admit right now.
What?
Basically, you can scratch off 2020 in terms of, you know, theatrical releases. I just can't see. I can't see them releasing Dune. I can't see them releasing Tenet. I mean, there's too many people scared to go back to the cinemas right now.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, poll after poll, you know, the majority of people say they're not going to go back to the movies until there's a vaccine. No.
Well, then you're talking spring to summer of 21, so...
Yeah. I mean, look, Sundance already jumped the gun, and they're going digital for 2021, for their 2021 edition.
I don't think I read that. You're saying that they are not going to have people trekking up to Park City this coming January?
They released a statement saying that they're going to have Sundance occur in a very limited way in select cities. So it's going to happen in like 20 different American cities, the screenings, if screenings are even allowed. And that there's going to most definitely be a digital component to next year's Sundance Film Festival.
So if there's a few venues that someone might want to risk going to, and with enough social distancing in the seating, you can actually see Sundance films for the year 2021 in around the country rather than Park City, and you can also theoretically see them concurrently as a digital stream if you're a press person or you have a ticket, or I wonder how that will work.
Probably both. They were very vague when they announced this new digital component and
right.
this countrywide screening process. But it seems like it's going to happen. And
yeah. It's
the product of the new director of Sundance.
Right.
Who's replacing John Cooper.
Yeah. So it's going to be basically like...